The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at Brown's Chapel in Selma, Alabama, ironically speaks of dying. 1 month and 3 years later, he would fall to an assassin's bullet.
Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right, he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80. If he's just as dead as 36, as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. He died. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true. So we're going to stand up right here amid horses. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy clubs. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas. We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up, letting the world know that we are determined to be free.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to A New Foreign Policy with Tom Ashbrook, Barry Posen, and William C. Wolford. For more than a half century, the United States has been the world's big global straddling superpower, but now new questions are being raised about whether the U.S. can still afford that role.
We're talking this hour about the call for a new, dramatically more modest foreign policy for the United States, an end to the global domination grand strategy, a new posture, a lower, less expensive profile in the world. You heard talk of talking with foes in the president's second inaugural address this week, but also you heard a lot of what has been the theme of the American grand strategy for half a century. Here was the president.
America will remain the anchor of strong alliances in every corner of the globe, and we will renew those institutions that extend our capacity to manage crisis abroad. For no one has a greater stake in a peaceful world than its most powerful nation. We will support democracy from Asia to Africa, from the Americas to the Middle East, because our interests and our conscience compel us to act on behalf of those who long for freedom.
From Asia to Africa, Americas to the Middle East, because of our interests and our conscience. The president there this week in his second inaugural address. Barry Posen is with us. His big piece in Foreign Affairs magazine is Pullback, the case for a less activist foreign policy. We're going to hear pushback to that in a moment. So what would this look like, Barry Posen? This new grand strategy, more modest, less out there, what would it look like?
I think the first thing we need to do is take a look at the allies who are fully capable of looking after themselves and asking ourselves the question of why we're continuing to look after them. I mean, Europe is rich. Europe is safe. The Americans had a great success with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a great success in containing the Soviet Union.
So bring the troops home from Europe and Japan, what is it, 180,000 or something?
Japan is a separate issue. Mm-hmm. But certainly in Europe, I think we can afford much greater reductions in troops. And I think we need to change the whole structure of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The military organization that's attached to NATO should just simply be handed back to the Europeans. The Supreme Allied Commander Europe should be
off
European.
You go, boys. Okay.
And the alliance should basically go back to what it was when it was originally conceived, which was simply a political alliance.
Okay,
right? The military part came later. It's one fairly significant piece. Second, in the Middle East Persian Gulf area, I think we have to make decisions about what really matters to us and what we can do. And I think one of the biggest choices we have to confront, and we're confronting it now, we're going to continue to have to confront, is what is our role in the internal politics of Arab countries and in social and political transformations within those countries?
It has seemed rather slight.
And I think it has to stay slight.
So that's not a change, is it?
Well, wait a second. We helped knock over the regime in Libya. We're having an argument about whether to help knock over the regime in Syria. We knocked over a regime in Iraq, right?
And we're
in business defending a lot of other regimes, right?
And Bahrain, Egypt for a long time.
Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So we have to decide exactly what it is we need to do there and what it is we probably can't do there. And I think this is a kind of below-the-radar kind of set of conversations, which we're barely having in this country. And That is, are we ever going to be in the peacekeeping counterinsurgency business in the Arab world again? And I think the answer is no, under no circumstances.
Okay, but does that mean pull back? I mean, we're still in there in a big way diplomatically, as you say, and we've got all kinds of forces around the Persian Gulf.
So second, it means much reducing U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, right? U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf are really there to defend countries from other countries, and they're really there at this point to defend Arab countries from Iran.
That's flow of oil?
That's what they're...
Isn't that the bottom line?
It's all about the flow of oil. It's all about the flow of oil.
Well, that oil, a lot of it comes to us and our allies.
No, very little of it comes to us. A lot of it goes to our allies, very little of it comes to us, and less is going to come to us. We're defending oil because of its utility to others, not because of its utility to us.
We don't have a security interest in keeping the Strait of Hormuz open?
You got to be careful with these things. There's a global oil market. If the straits are closed, the global price of oil goes up, it's bad for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. That's all true. So keeping the straits open is in our interest, ensuring that that there's no oil hegemon in the Persian Gulf, which is, say, in this case, Iran doesn't succeed at becoming a hegemon in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. Those are all in our interest. The United States doesn't have to have huge forces on the ground to protect these interests. These are basically naval and air problems, right? And the presence of those forces on the ground helps make enemies, domestic enemies to the United States, right, in terms of political currents within the country, and it commits us implicitly to help defend those regimes from their internal problems. And I don't think the United States wants to be a part of that.
If we weren't in there, what would happen? I mean, you heard Hillary Clinton today saying, if the U.S. isn't there, things get ugly in a hurry.
I already suggested to you that this is a two-edged sword. If we are there, things get ugly in a hurry, too, because people take their ugliness out on us. Right. Our presence is not loved by others.
But is your suggestion that people would work it out for themselves if they didn't think, you know, Big Daddy, Big Cop was going to come in?
There's two issues here. Their domestic politics has to take whatever course it's going to take. Our interest is about their security situation relative to outsiders. Our interests are very limited. Right. As you said, right, to the extent that there are interests, it's about the flow of oil from the Gulf, and it's about avoiding Iranian hegemony in the Gulf. And there are many ways to skin a cat, and there are many ways for us to pursue this strategy. And getting ever more deeply in bed with these Arab regimes is not necessarily the most intelligent way to pursue that strategy.
If the U.S. globally lightened its footprint along the lines that you outline in your big essay, Pullback, how much could we cut from American military spending? How much would it save us in annual outlays?
Well, different people have different ideas about this. The work that I've done, I think it's something like a quarter to a third. You could get a cut of between a quarter and a third.
So we're talking many hundreds of billions here.
It could be $150 billion, something like that.
Okay.
Could be that much, maybe a bit more. You know, these figures are squishy because we're talking about years, we're talking about decades, we're talking about a growing GDP, we're talking about military costs that always seem to go up. So it's...
That's a money savings, and on top of that, you're saying there would actually be a security savings because...
Yeah, I prefer to think in terms of force structure cuts, right? Mm-hmm. And because I don't believe the United States should be in the counterinsurgency business anymore, and there aren't many land threats in the world that where there's one country getting ready to conquer another that is an interest of ours, my biggest cuts fall on the Army, and I would cut the Army in half, right? Smaller cuts fall on the Navy. I cut the Navy by a quarter, cut the Air Force by a quarter in terms of force structure.
And would the world be a calmer place without what you see sometimes as the American provocation, would it be a mess and we just wouldn't care?
I think calmer place is not the correct way to talk about these things. The world is not a calm place now. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a calm place then. The question is a question of American interests. What are American interests? What does America need to do for its core security purposes? What is the core security situation in the United States? We haven't discussed in this conversation what are the essential facts of the American strategic position. The president says we're not secure unless we're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, how is it possible that a country that's the richest, most capable economy in the world and is destined to remain one of the top two or three economies in the world, with a huge resource base on its own continent, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. protected on the east and west by vast oceans, mm-hmm. bordered on the north and south by weak and pliant states,
Canada,
possessed
Mexico.
Of a huge military capability, and mm-hmm. possessed of nuclear weapons, how is it this country isn't inherently one of the most secure countries that ever existed in the world?
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof. Won't pay for a drink if you gotta have proof. Try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. And there's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus and hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes? Yeah, right. Now I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before. Except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now. They haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they'll never know need. Their shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, and to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. So that's how it is, that's what we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains, it's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. And dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. You can't make it here anymore.
Barry Posen looking to reorient our thinking, the nation's thinking about the country's grand strategy today. We'll hear pushback in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, you're on the air.
Good. Hello, Tom. First of all, we have a multi-trillion dollar debt that we can't seem to resolve, and about $3 trillion of that is due to the Iraq War, according to a Nobel Prize economist, I think his name is Stiglitz. And we have so many problems here that we always say we can't address because we don't have the money. So why are we spending about 50% of our budget on military endeavors, which only create more enemies for us around the world? Seems like to me what we ought to do is increase our tiny little expenditure for foreign aid. It's only about 1% of our budget, and do health, education, and microfinance programs around the world so that we build friendships and solve a lot of those problems that are causing wars in third world countries.
So change that profile, you say. Keep an eye on our debt. Figure out how to bring down the cost of being out there in such an expensive way. Elaine, thanks for that. Let me get one more. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Daniel's calling. Daniel, you're on with Barry Posen.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to respond to something your guest had said earlier about the military, American military presence being in hopes to create some sort of utopian society.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree. I think really, at least what should be, our presence should be more of a in a response to a moral duty of these resources that we have. I think that we enjoy as a result of taking advantage of the power that we have.
Are you saying a moral duty to spread freedom, democracy? What exactly, Daniel?
Yeah, exactly. These basic human rights that everyone should enjoy. Sam Harris in his book The Moral Landscape describes these moral axioms that are just basic in human life.
And is it the job of the United States to go in and fight for those around the world? Is that your basic position, Daniel?
Well, yeah, I believe because of the position that we have, the power that we have that is enjoyed by us because of the way we take advantage of the entire, global economy,
mm-hmm.
I think we have a moral duty to use the resources that we have to help others in the most basic way.
Daniel, I appreciate your call. I mean, President Obama in his inaugural speech, second inaugural again this week, kind of seconding that with a reference to Martin Luther King, where he was saying, no one is really free unless everybody is free. That's got global implications. On the other hand, Martin Luther King was very critical of American spending in Vietnam. It gets tricky in a hurry. Barry Posen is with me in the studio from MIT. His essay is Pullback, the Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy. I want to bring you into our conversation right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, William Wolforth. He co-authored a rebuttal to Barry Posen's big essay. It also runs in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. He co-authored it with Stephen Brooks and John Eikenberry. It's titled Lean Forward, not Pullback, but Lean Forward in Defense of American Engagement. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. William Wolforth, thank you very much for being with us today.
That's nice to be here, Tom.
So begin your rebuttal. Barry Posen looks around the world, and you hear his case. It's very expensive to be out there the way we have, and it may create more problems than it solves. We need to pull back. You say lean forward still. Why?
Oh, it's a great debate, and we owe a lot of debt to Barry Posen for raising it. But if you think about the questions he raises, I think you'll come to the conclusion that the core of the strategy continues to be in America's interest. And we need to stress what that core is. The core is a series of security guarantees to partners and allies around the world, as a result of which bad things that could happen don't happen. We make the world more secure, making it better for the United States over the long run by making our partners less likely to take actions which would lead to their neighborhoods and ultimately to the world being less secure.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that, Bill? How does that work? Security guarantees, therefore less trouble. Why?
Well, take an example. Say Japan. The United States and Japan have a security treaty, which we renewed after the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, Japan, yes, as Barry Posen says, only spends 1% of its GDP on defense, but also doesn't do a lot of other things that it would probably do if it felt less secure. It probably would want to have its own nuclear weapons. It would probably want to have a much more capable military. And the result would be fear and concern among its neighbors, in particular China, but also countries like South Korea. And the result could well be an East Asia back in a world of much more intense security competition.
Military buildup, competition, fear.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So the tricky thing about this debate is that a lot of the good things that we see about the world, a lot of security that that Barry Posen talks about, may well be the result of these commitments that we've made. So the strategy in many ways is preventing a worse world from emerging. The strategy that we have now is the kind of the devil we know, and we see its problems, and yes, its expenses, and yes, sometimes it goes overboard in its expectations about what can be done. But what you don't see is the world that would emerge if we seriously pulled back, by which I mean revoking or dramatically scaling back these core security commitments.
Well, let me just ask on that, if I may probe on that, William Walforth. I mean, we've certainly had trouble with this strategy. We've seen wars that have gone in very, very difficult and extremely costly directions. It's not as though it's been all sweetness and light under this policy. And we've seen our military spending just, I mean, awfully high, maybe not the highest it's been in history as a percentage of GDP, but crazy high compared to anybody else. So it already seems troubled and very expensive, does it not?
It does, but partly the ramp-up in defense spending occurring after 2001 is the result of a particular response to the challenge of al-Qaeda-style terrorism that the country attempted to implement. And that ended up in, yes, very expensive wars and partly an increase in defense expenditures to the current level. By all estimates, including even those of Governor Romney when he was running for president, these expenditures are going to come down as we exit the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to a level of defense spending of around, probably most people expect it'll end up being around 3.5% of GDP, which is pretty low by historical standards.
And the argument that simply by being out there, you say we're preventing worse things from happening. Barry Posen says, you know what? We're actually provoking a lot of thorny things that happen. We create a lot of resentment. Part of the reason al-Qaeda went after the United States in 2001 was the presence, bin Laden always said, of American troops in Saudi Arabia. What about that? Do we create more trouble than we solve or prevent?
I think at the end of the day, we get more benefits than costs. As I say, many of the costs are observable and some of the benefits aren't observable. But still, at the end of the day, the question to ask yourself is, we came out of the Cold War with a large network of alliances and partnerships, good relationships with countries that help us do things in the world, help us cooperate to solve problems that are in our mutual interest. The question is, these things are like assets. Do you want to keep them or do you want to throw them away? In general, I view the world as, yes, a place that's potentially dangerous in the future, and I'd like to sustain these alliances. I'd like to sustain these partnerships rather than get rid of them, bearing in mind that they do sometimes generate costs. Our allies sometimes are not the perfect allies we would wish, that would obey every single thing we would like them to do and also spend more and more on defense. It is imperfect. It creates management problems. You have your Benghazis. You have your Senate hearings where you have American officials grilled for all the problems. And sometimes it seems like, wouldn't it be better just to get away from all that, just come home? At the end of the day, I'm convinced that the benefits dramatically outweigh the cost.
What you know? Well, I'll tell you what I know. congressman to your president are all businessmen just scheming. But telling who's your enemy and who's your friend, well, I'm not sure that I believe them. When street side posters are encouraging me peeping to report my local terrorists and the company that keep it. It's propaganda. Now it's everywhere I look, it's a propaganda. Man, it's just like in history books, propaganda. You know, like who are they in Guantanamo Bay, sir? 'Cause there ain't no names and no crimes written in my paper. The racial prisoner who's wondering why his charges, secret meetings in taxi cab garages, propaganda. Now it's everywhere I go, another propaganda.
Now for something completely different.